Today's episode of This Week I Learned is brought to you by the 400 horsepower Lincoln MKZ and the Lincoln MKZ Hybrid. Which will you choose? Hello and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned that your mood can change how the flu vaccine affects you. The flu vaccine is not 100% effective. Not only does your personal health and well-being affect how your immune system responds to the vaccine, but there's also the small detail that the flu strain can change season to season and person to person. So you may diligently get your flu vaccine and then wham, you're hit with the influenza strain AH3N2, which totally doesn't match the vaccine strain you got, and now you're laid up in bed for a week. But researchers out of the UK wanted to see what other factors might influence the effectiveness of that annual shot. There are tons of physiological and lifestyle factors that act as immune modulators. Things like sleep, stress, physical activity, mood, and even nutrition can adjust your immune system enough to make it more or less susceptible to the vaccine. So researchers recruited 138 adults between the ages of 65 and 85 because older adults are especially affected by the flu. For the study, volunteers had a few weeks prior to the flu shot where they kept track of things like their food and drink intake, physical activity, mood, stress, and sleep. They also had a pre-vaccine blood test to check antibody levels. On the day of the flu shot, the volunteers completed a questionnaire that measured their positive or negative moods. And then for a month after the shot, the participants continued to keep track of these same physiological factors. And at the end of the month, they had another blood test to check those antibody levels. And through all of that data and all of those multiple factors measured from food to exercise, researchers found that there was really only one thing that influenced whether the vaccine worked or not: a person's mood. Being in a better mood significantly predicted greater antibody responses to the flu shot. The mood boost helped before, during, and after the shot, but it appeared to have a particularly strong influence on the day of the vaccine, indicating that if you're happy the day you get that hit in the arm, you could be saving yourself days of illness-induced misery down the line. Researchers aren't quite sure why this is, but they suspect that there could be a link between positive moods and healthier lifestyles. But there could also be a sort of backdoor channel linking the immune system and the brain mechanisms that regulate our moods. Either way, this upcoming flu season, try enjoying the flu shot for once, or at least looking forward to that lollipop you get afterward. This week I learned that science has identified 5 distinct types of cat personalities. Did you know there was a time when scientists rolled their eyes at the possibility of animals having personalities? Luckily, we've emerged from this dark time in our scientific history, and researchers are beginning to see the light. Namely, that identifying personality types in pets can actually help in caring for them. To get to the bottom of what type of cat personalities there are, researchers conducted a really large poll of nearly 3,000 cat owners from South Australia and New Zealand. The owners filled out a survey measuring 52 personality traits. Using these answers, researchers were able to identify 5 different personalities, each with their own particular traits. There's the extroverts. Cats that are active, vigilant, curious, inquisitive, inventive, and smart. There's the neurotics, cats that are insecure, anxious, fearful of people, suspicious, and shy. Then there's the dominant types, the bully cats, those that are aggressive to other cats. Then there are the impulsive cats, the ones that act erratically and recklessly. And finally, there are the agreeable cats, the affectionate types that are friendly to people and very gentle. Now, what's really interesting is what these personalities may say about what your cat needs. Extroverts may need additional stimulation, for example, and more complex environments to challenge them and help them avoid boredom. Also, if your cat was once an extrovert and is no longer, that could indicate some age-related health issues, either cognitive or physical, that you may want to get checked out by a vet. The behavior of impulsive cats may indicate that their environment is too stressful for them. Stressful environments can negatively affect a cat's health and welfare. If you address these environmental issues, you'll know that you've fixed the problem when your cat starts acting less erratically. Neurotic cats may also be stressed, but it may not have to do with their environment and more about their interaction with other humans and animals. To help neurotic cats, you can provide them with more hiding places around the home or access to quiet spaces. Agreeable cats are pretty much perfect, which is great for pet owners, but can actually be really helpful for the not-so-well-adjusted cats. So if you have an impulsive or neurotic cat, it might help to bring in an agreeable cat to calm things down a bit. Now, researchers aren't quite sure what to do about the dominant cats. There isn't a clear connection between a bully cat's behavior and their caring needs, except to perhaps keep them away from the more insecure cats if you have them. Researchers actually think that dominance may have a biological influence rather than a nurturing one due to the high levels of oxytocin found in dominant cats. So the lesson here for all you cat people out there, assess your cat's personality and watch for any changes as it ages to help that coy little buddy live a happy and healthy life. This week I learned about an ancient species of frog that likely terrorized the dinosaurs. The Beelzebufo ampyga, also known as the devil frog, lived 70 million years ago and may have been the largest frog ever. Growing up to 10 pounds and reaching 16 inches in length, the amphibian was about the size of a beach ball. Rather ill-tempered and quite aggressive, devil frogs were known to sit quietly in the jungles of Madagascar and snap up anything that happened by it. What was most impressive about the devil frog was its jaw strength. In a new study, researchers analyzed the bite of similar frogs living today to find out just how strong that jaw was. Using a tool that resembles a tiny pair of tongs with soft leather on the ends, they measured the frog's bite force. Then researchers compared that force to the frog's mass and head size. Putting that data into a computer program, they were able to estimate that the more massive devil frog could have had a bite force of slightly more than 2,000 newtons. That's almost 500 pounds of force. To put it another way, that's the kind of force a lion or a bear uses when ripping into some fresh flesh. And researchers think that with this kind of force, the devil frog could have dined on small crocodiles and even dinosaurs. This week I learned that during the 1920s, death-defying stunt airplane flights were prescribed by doctors to cure all sorts of ailments. The end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century was an experimental time in the world of medicine, to put it delicately. Drugs were crudely concocted through a mixture of experimentation and prayer. Pharmaceutical chemists sought magic bullets for a range of diseases. Salesmen hawked drug-laced elixirs as cure-alls. And if you listen to episode 65 of This Week I Learned, you'll know that even chocolate was pitched as a medical miracle. Basically, science just hadn't caught up to the times, and professional and amateur medics were throwing spaghetti at the wall in the name of health and often profit. So in this context, airplane rides as prescriptions for what ails does not seem so crazy. Aviation was still very much new, and some doctors in America and Europe looked to the technology as a last-ditch way to sort of shock the system. So by the time they paid a hefty sum, sometimes $50, which would be more like $700 today, to get into a stunt plane, patients had usually tried everything at their disposal, and their afflictions were usually quite serious. There was the soldier who had lost the ability to talk, And after being taken up 12 to 14,000 feet in the air and plummeting seemingly to the ground, the soldier emerged from the airplane shaken, but reportedly able to speak. And according to Smithsonian Magazine, the anecdotal evidence that the death-defying airplane rides could shock the system back to functioning began to spread far and wide. Soon, people were paying top dollar to try and cure everything from speech impairments, deafness, to chronic insomnia. The aviation magazine Flying concluded that this was the dawn of the aerial sanatorium and the aerotherapist. Military pilots, including Charles Lindbergh, who were home from the war, took on side jobs spinning deaf and ill patients in loop-de-loops in the air. Perhaps, unsurprisingly, not all flights were the medical miracles they had claimed to be, and several ended tragically. In 1928, a 45-year-old professional pianist who feared he was losing his hearing was killed along with the pilot and a fellow musician when their plane went into a steep dive that caused one of its wings to buckle. By the end of the 1920s, the airplane cure was on its way out. Several reputable organizations and medical journals debunked the treatment, and public opinion finally gained a hefty, and let's admit it here, appropriate amount of skepticism. Besides, adventurous pilots had more exciting feats to accomplish in the world of aviation.
And back in 1927, there was a high-wing monoplane filled with fuel to bursting, climbing heavily above Long Island, vanishing from view. 33 hours later, Charles Lindbergh had flown non-stop New York to Paris, into the headlines of the nations, into the fable of the times.
And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you'd like to read more about the facts I've mentioned, you can check out theweek.com/podcasts, where you'll also find our 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainers podcasts. And if you've come across any fascinating studies, scientific tidbits, or historic revelations, email me. You can find me at podcasts@theweek.com. Both singular and plural will get you there. Just put podcast in the subject. And until next week, I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.